Whether you're making the same breakfast that you have every day or baking a cake for an extra special day, eggs are a staple in our diets. Eggland's Best eggs are nutritionally superior to ordinary eggs, containing more vitamins and 25% less saturated fat. Not only are they better for you, but Eggland's Best eggs taste better too. There's a reason that they're America's number one eggs. Visit egglandsbest.com for additional information and delicious recipes.
If you like this show, and we hope you do, you should check out Slate's Culture Gabfest. The Gabfest is a weekly show featuring culture critics Stephen Metcalf, Dana Stevens, and Julia Turner. Tune in to hear them analyze all the latest cultural happenings from highbrow to pop and everything in between. You'll hear about what's new and noteworthy in film, television, music, and art, as well as healthy debates about all the stories that are currently blowing up your social feeds. New York Times critic Dwight Garner says, "The Slate Culture Gabfest is one of the highlights of my week." Search for Culture Gabfest wherever you get your podcasts. Warning, this podcast contains spoilers for the Guardians of the Galaxy franchise and the MCU, including Volumes 1, 2, and 3. Hello, my name is Jason Concepcion.
And I'm Rosie Knight.
And welcome to X-Ray Vision, the Crooked Media podcast where we dive deep into your favorite shows, movies, comics, and pop culture.
On this week's episode, we're going into space. It's Guardians of the Galaxy, baby. In previously on, we're going to be recapping and reflecting on the Guardians of the Galaxy franchise thus far and getting you up to speed on where all your favorite characters are. In the airlock, we're going to be talking Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3. So if you haven't seen it, spoiler alert, go and see it and then listen to this episode. And in Nerd Out, there's going to be a relevantly spacey theory about Star Wars from listener Tony.
I love it. Coming up, previously on. First up in the previously on, we will be looking back at the first two installments in the Guardians of the Galaxy franchise and the MCU to get you up to speed for Guardians of the Galaxy 3, and also a check-in on where the characters from the Guardians team ended up after the various tie-ins that they appear in. Mostly
what have
Endgame.
They been up to?
Yeah, mostly Endgame, some Thor Love and Thunder, and also, of course, the Christmas special.
The cheeky
Shall we
little
begin?
Holiday special. Let's do it. Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 1 introduced us to the, at the time, extremely deep-cut titular team. It was a bombastic space adventure.
That's right.
There was 80s music listened to by the hero Star-Lord, who was kidnapped as a child by space pirates known as the Ravagers and was raised by their leader, Yondu. You may remember him. As an adult, he's a quick-talking thief with quips for days, and on a routine mission to steal a valuable artifact known as the Orb, he becomes entangled with Gamora, the daughter of the tyrant Thanos. Remember him?
Important
in the MCU? When she is sent after him by a violent Kree alien known as Ronan the Accuser. Lee Pace! In the MCU! Still
doing
shocking.
Doing fantastic things, Lee Pace.
Thespianing. He's thespianing. Gamora and Quillasoon waylaid by bounty hunters. Groot, a talking tree. And Rocket Raccoon, a gun-toting raccoon. But in the end, they have to come together to save Gamora from another strange alien known as Drax the Destroyer, who wants to kill her because his family was killed by Ronan the Accuser.
Now we should have some interesting
dynamics.
Some interesting context for our Ronan the Accuser on the
Ooh,
rewatch.
Yes.
So Ronan is a member of the Kree race as an accuser, an important figure in the judicial process, but has broken off from the Kree because they signed a peace treaty that he doesn't like. And so he's taken this job to get a certain orb that contains a certain gem for one Thanos, because Thanos has been collecting those things. Big time collector. He wants all the gems, as we all remember, the Infinity Stones.
Loves those gems.
He's tasked Ronan with doing it, but Ronan has taken the gig, but also he wants to keep the stone so that he can blow up the treaty and decimate Xandar, the planet with which the Kree have signed a treaty with.
Yeah, and he wants to put the stone on his super cool hammer.
That's right.
And make a super powered hammer. Jason, do you remember the first time watching this movie? Because
I
feel like I feel like as MCU fans, the first time watching Guardians of the Galaxy was just kind of a mind-blowing experience.
It was. It was that stage in the evolution of the MCU where I'm like, I can't believe they're doing this. Mm-hmm. You know, it was the real, obviously, putting all the Avengers together in a team was a pretty big swing. Creating a shared universe is a big swing. Mm-hmm. But this is the real heat check movie where, you know, the big criticism of the MCU at launch was like, nobody cares about Captain America. Nobody cares about Iron Man.
Yeah.
Nobody cares about the Hulk. And that was true. And let me tell you, nobody really, really, really nobody gave a shit about the Guardians of the Galaxy. And this is, I mean, they're fun if you are a true, like, Marvel comics, Marvel cosmic comics nerd.
If you're digging in the back issue bins.
Digging in the back issue. And this is not even the original team. This is like the team that emerges after Annihilation. Yeah, after a bunch of cosmic Marvel crossovers. And it really felt like, God, I don't know if people will like this. It'll be crazy if people like this. And it was fun. Really super fun movie. Obviously, I think the music has become a hallmark of the series and continues with Guardians of the Galaxy 3. Some really, they've expanded past the 80s. They were there into the 90s and the 2000s now in Guardians 3. That's a little bit of a spoiler. But just super fun. I really enjoyed it. Do you remember what your thoughts were when you first saw it?
I saw it at like a midnight screening, I think, or a very late night screening at the IMAX in London, which at the time I think was one of the biggest screens in the world. And I remember that opening so well with, you know, Peter, he's going through space and he's listening to his headphones and he's kind of like kicking little lizards. I really came out of it like, wow, they Star Wars the MCU in like what I felt like was a very enjoyable way. And this was pre-sequel trilogy, right? So it felt very different. I mean, it's wild to think this was only the fourth film in phase two of the MCU. So
it's
like
so
you say,
wild.
It was just a total tone shift. I think obviously like exploded James Gunn into the stratosphere. And yeah, made the music and needle drops such a huge part of the MCU, which hadn't really been a thing before because it was such a score-based, cinematic, operatic, serious take on the franchise. Whereas this was much more pop culture reference heavy. You had Peter who grew up in the 80s. So he had these memories of an Earth that had never been updated, which allowed for a lot of fun nostalgia. It was just a totally different vibe for the MCU.
Let me ask you this. So rewatching this, it struck me that we don't know how a lot of the gems ended up where they are. Like, you know, we just, Peter is tasked by the broker who is just a guy with a storefront and a brick
just
and mortar shop on Xandar. Literally just a guy with a jewelry store.
He's like, it would be cool to have an orb.
Yeah,
I'd like an orb.
Hey, will you go get the orb for me? And we never really find out how it got there. It would be so cool to find out at some point in the future how all the Infinity Gems got to the places where they eventually got picked up at.
I would love that. I think that could actually be something really cool to do in the animated stuff because there is a great bit of exposition we get in this movie that kind of is the next part. The team, they team up together sort of unexpectedly, this ragtag alliance of convenience. And then another one of my favorite big swing weird moments from this movie, we head to Nowhere, which is a floating outpost of kind of like Ravagers and bad guys and anti-heroes and space pirates.
Just kind of an open city in space inside the head of a celestial.
Casually. Just a floating celestial head. So note that, Eternals lovers, because you're hearing the word celestial for the first time here. And Celestials actually end up playing a large part in the ongoing Guardians of the Galaxy franchise. And they end up going to the Collector, played by Benicio del Toro, who's so great in this movie.
Really just creepy and weird.
And he's so weird and he's so over the top. And he is even more of a fan of collecting things than Thanos. And he does that great, one of my favorite MCU exposition dumps where he explains the histories of the Infinity Gems and how they were created. But that's it. You get the millennia year old history and then they're just here. I feel like let's explore that. I would absolutely love to know. What have they been up to? Who had him before? We know it wasn't Adam Warlock, like in the comics.
Yeah, how did it end up on Morag?
Mm-hmm.
Who had it? What were they doing with it?
Who put it in this nice little orb? So yeah, they go and see the collector, and we get a very good info dump. We learn about the power gem. It's very powerful. Give you almost infinite powers. And if you have them all, then of course we know you can snap out half of the universe. Spoiler alert, that happened. They got to battle Ronan. Ronan wants the power gem for himself, but he's also consistently snitching to Thanos about the Guardians. So yeah. Thanos kind of has a good idea of what's going on. They ultimately head back to Xandar, as you mentioned, where a lot of people thought they were going to see Nathan Fillion as Nova. It didn't happen, but we did get to see the Nova corpse in one of the epic things falling out of the sky third act battles in Marvel history.
Yes.
It's still one of the most impressive ones. I have a
note for all supervillains. Obviously, pointedly, Ronan the Accuser in Guardians of the Galaxy, Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 1, but also General Zod in Man of Steel. Oh. If you're going to destroy a planet, go anywhere and destroy it. You don't go to like the capital city where all the military forces are. Like, make it, do it. I understand, like, this was an act of hubris by Ronan. He wanted to like make a big speech before he did all the shit. But like, go to the middle of the fucking ocean and destroy it.
Take some notes from the Death Star. Destroy it from far away.
Yeah, destroy it from far away.
You got the Power Stone. You can do something.
You don't need to get on the ground.
You don't need to be on the planet.
Yeah,
and then ultimately,
anywhere.
You know, get beaten in a dance battle with Peter Quill, a very famous MCU moment.
And this is honestly a mistake that a lot of supervillains make. Mephisto has done this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Namor has done it. They always invade, like, New York City. It's like the Avengers, the X-Men, everybody lives here.
They live there, bro. Like, please.
go somewhere out in the middle of nowhere and destroy.
It's definitely the physical version of monologuing.
Yeah.
It's like, don't tell somebody your plan before you've enacted it. And don't go to the central city, especially here where, as we see, there are like thousands of Nova Corps ships. Like, yeah. This is like a heavily defended place.
Yes.
And of course, you know, spoiler alert, but it is an MCU movie and it's not Infinity War. The Guardians come out on top. And as the
little
movie
dance
comes,
battle, we get a little
dance
a
battle,
fun dance battle.
Which is one of, again, these are those hallmarks. It's interesting because it's so sincere.
It really
and
is.
And stylized. I don't know if it's full camp, but there are definitely campier elements to this movie than a lot of the MCU movies. Having a dance battle, this kind of ongoing joke about the headphones, the tapes, the music, Peter's nostalgia, his ship is called the Milano. Though, I will say, on merchandise, including the recent Lego release, they call it the Guardian ship. So I wonder if Alyssa Milano sent them a little letter.
Well, I will say that Ronan, I mean, Lee Pace is straight out camp in this movie.
Oh, yeah, he knows. Lee Pace knew what he was doing.
Every line reading is just so insane. What are you doing? When they start
dancing. He's chewing every piece of scenery
up. Oh, my God.
With his full 6.5 foot stature and his thespian training. Lovely Pace. Still blows my mind every day when I think that he was in the MCU. And this is just
Xandar,
such a
you stand accused. Your wretched peace treaty will not save you. It will be the tinder on which you burn. Like, okay.
And he's wearing like a dramatic, glamorous hood. And he's got a giant hammer. He's really doing the most in a delightful fashion.
Yeah.
And as the movie comes to an end, we learn an important plot point for Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2. That Yondu didn't just kidnap Peter for no reason.
It was not random. He didn't just end up there on Earth.
It was not a mistaken identity,
yeah, yeah.
Which I think was kind of the vibe that Peter had been told. In fact, the night Peter's mother died of a brain tumor and Peter ran out and was so upset, he was kidnapped by Yondu because Yondu had been hired by Peter's mysterious father, who happened to be a powerful deity. And Peter now learns this shocking fact, and we head into the wilds of Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2. I mean, this movie made so much money. for the movie.
An incredible amount of money.
It was like $773 million worldwide.
And you know, the moment when Groot creates the Groot ball to save everybody, it still gets me. It's and it's so beautiful in there with the little flowers and his I think they've made him like meaner ever since he got reduced to a twig. Like he had this very placid and gentle look in his eyes in the first movie. And it's, you know, when they're sitting there inside the Groot ball and Rocket is like, but you'll die, you know, don't do this. And it's like, and you just look at Groot's face and he's so at peace with it. Mm-hmm. It really is just like a wonderful moment.
You know what? I think I'm so glad you brought that up because that actually is such a vital part of why I think these films have become so popular. It is this bombastic, silly, camp, colorful adventure, much like the old space adventure serial kind of stuff. But it has a very effective emotional heart, and that is a lot of that comes from Groot, from Rocket, from the relationships of this found family, from Drax, who lost his family and then comes in and tries to rebuild, even though all he really wants to do is kill the man who killed his family. And I love that, because that's the line I think when Groot says, "We are Groot."
Yeah, we and are. And that, and by the way, setting the stage for something that happens in Guardians 3, which will be a shocking moment,
twist.
Letting you know that, yes, if he wants to, Groot does have a somewhat larger vocabulary, which is sort of canon in the comics. And I mean, when he appears in, I believe it's Annihilation Conquest, right? Or is it Annihilation? Yeah, it's Annihilation Conquest, right? Right. He is like saying full sentences and stuff before the movie came out, and then all of a sudden it's just "I am Groot."
Yes, it's a very interesting evolution of the character, and the version that we know as the Guardians of the Galaxy is the Annihilation Conquest version, though. It's very interesting because that's 2008 and the original team was 1969, you know, created by some legends in comics like Gene Colan and, you know, Roy Thomas was in there. Arnold Drake was the one who wrote the first issue. And then obviously we always have to shout him out. It was Bill Mantlo who was a co-creator of Rocket Raccoon, who sadly was in a hit and run accident many years ago and is still in care at the moment of his brother. And you can go to the Hero Initiative and find out ways to support him and other comic book creators, because these movies do not exist without them. And Bill Mantlo is like a huge part of the Guardians legacy, especially when it comes to Volume 3, because of the importance of Rocket Raccoon. Yes. But before then, it was 2017. It was 3 years after Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 1, which was originally just called The Guardians of the Galaxy, but is now retroactively called Volume 1, as we are now with Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2. Mixtape relevant. Now, rewatching this movie and writing a recap for it is like one of the funniest things I've ever done. And you're going to understand.
It's a nuts movie.
It's absolutely bonkers.
It's fucking insane.
I love Kurt Russell so much. So I'm just so happy to always watch a Kurt Russell movie. But I will begin with this sentence that sums up the energy of this movie specifically, and also quite a lot of the energy of Volume 3. While protecting some magical batteries for the golden aliens known as the Sovereign in order to free Nebula from the aliens' crutches, the Guardians are saved from a battle with their supposed Sovereign allies by an unknown battalion. It is led by the Celestial Ego, known in the comics as Ego the Living Planet, who is literally a planet in the comics, who soon reveals himself to be Peter's biological father. As they head to Ego's homeworld, Aisha, the golden-skinned lady played by Elizabeth Debicki, who is the leader of the Sovereign, the High Priestess, and is very relevant for Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3,
yes.
She hires Yondu and his Ravagers to hunt down the Guardians. Important to note here, something Jason has pointed out to me that I had forgotten. The reason she can hire Yondu is because Yondu and his Ravagers have been thrown out
of
the Ravager community. Why?
For trafficking children.
For trafficking children. And not only trafficking them, but trafficking them to their deaths.
You may dress like us, but you'll never hear the hordes of freedom when you die, Yondu. And the colors of a gourd will never flash over your grave.
In case you didn't know,
and that is Stakar Agord, played by Sylvester Stallone, who summarily ejects Yondu from the Ravager community for being a serial trafficker of children to Ego, the living planet, who end up dead. How many children? I mean, at the end of this movie, in the final third of this movie, you will see a pile of bones who are the children who, unlike Peter, did not survive being trafficked. Well, he never delivered Peter to Ego.
Yeah.
But, you know, he delivered the rest of them. And this pile of bones, folks, you've heard me talk about this before. The pile of bones.
It's immense.
It's like 40 feet high, maybe 90, 100 feet wide. It's like a pile. Like, it's got to contain certainly thousands. Now, you might
Definitely thousands. I think Ego said it at least thousands.
Right. And now many have said to me, well, you know, in an attempt to absolve Yondu of quite
Ego
all the guilt.
Apologists.
No, I get it. And I get it because, like, listen, they make Yondu is the father figure in this movie. And he's
the adoptive dad.
Essentially a good guy throughout the rest of the series. They point out that surely Ego had other traffickers, which is probably true, right? Like, if you just do the math, it seems like unless Yondu was rounding up like 100 at a time, it probably would have taken too long. So maybe Yondu is only responsible for like 20% of the pile, but well, that is still so many.
That's a lot.
And by the way, I would then counter with, what is the minimum number of children that you could deliver
exactly
to their death
before you are allowed.
Also, before you're fine.
I will also say, as proven by the existence, continued existence of Peter Quill, it was very easy for Yondu to actually save one of those children and not deliver them to Ego. It took Ego like 30 years to find this guy. Yondu really could have been not delivering the children.
I gotta say, apparently he was getting too old because the implication is because he kept Peter alive because Peter was small enough to like wriggle through like ducts and different things.
Yes, he was useful as a thief.
So I guess what they're implying there is that the other kids that Yondu delivered Ego were maybe a little bit older, like young adult side, not quite so
acceptable
young.
Acceptable trafficking age.
Legally adult.
It's like, if you're killed by your father, who is an omnipotent celestial being, when you're an adult, it's not as bad.
I'll just say
this. As if it was a kid.
Yondu might be redeemed in the course of Guardians of the Galaxy 2 and 3. That may have happened. But he'll never hear the horns of freedom when he dies. And the colors of a gourd? The colors of a gourd will never flash over his grave.
They will never flash over his grave. And that's
all
that's
I have to say
punishment.
About that.
That's all we have to say about that. This is a movie that's all about daddy issues. You've got Gamora and Nebula who are kind of battling each other. Nebula wants to kill Thanos and they end up in this fight that ends, luckily for everyone, in a sisterly reunion of some kind. You also have the fact that Yondu, who is sent by Aisha, doesn't actually want to give over Quill because that is his son.
Yeah, he
has love for him. He's a good guy, human trafficker, but good guy. And of course, the biggest daddy issues belong to Peter, who learns that not only is his father Ego an omnipotent super being, but also a giant dick. Just a super dick.
Multiple-time child murderer, and also the reason that his mom is his dad, but the reason his mom died.
Yes. We learn that not only has Ego spent millennia traveling the universe, trying to sire children so he can terraform planets with the celestial
very
powers.
Zeus-like. Very, very, very Greek mythology-like.
Very Titan-ish. And he is going to find the child who can harness the celestial powers and the two of them can terraform the universe in Ego's nightmarish, delightful Kurt Russell form. And as Jason pointed out, heartbreakingly, it is also revealed that Ego, for some reason, gave Peter's mom a brain tumor. Evil. I mean, already very evil behavior, but seems extra evil, unnecessary.
Very unnecessary.
Bad times. So, yes, all bad. And if that wasn't bad enough, oh, shock horror, guess what? We already talked about it. Yondu, Peter's other dad, was helping his real dad kill all these children. So it's all bad times.
You know what I've realized? So much evil happens in the MCU and in the cosmic MCU because of the gig economy. Just the Sovereign. You have this massive fleet. Just go get Peter Quill. Why are you? I get it. Yondu knows him.
But why are you hiring him? Just go yourself.
Yeah, why don't you just like be like, hey, where would he go? And then act on that information. Just do it yourself. Ego, you are immensely powerful. We've seen you move around in human form, go to Earth and meet up with Peter's mom and go. And clearly you went to other planets, did the same thing. Why do you need all these like Postmates deliveries of kids? Just go do it.
You could use your just do it yourself. Celestial powers to summon them to you or something. I'm sure there is. And you're just gonna trust some rando guy in like a flying kind of junk trap? I don't know.
And look,
look what happened,
Ego. Look what happened. The one kid who you were looking for is the one kid that Yondu is like, I'm gonna keep this one.
Mm-hmm. And not only that, but you're so bad at planning that like stopped you in your tracks.
You
with
were
your
just
plan.
Spinning your wheels for
just spinning
years
your wheels,
and years and years after that.
Waiting to find Peter Quill and his little Zoon. And the big, I would say, the big introduction here is not Ego. As much as I would have loved to see Kurt Russell become a super big bad in the MCU, I love Kurt Russell. I love Ego the Living Planet, such a weird character. The real heavy hitter here is Mantis.
I love Mantis. Mantis for the comics. Was delighted to see her come to life in the MCU.
Yeah, just such a delightful performance by Pom Klemtief and just a wonderful, kind character whose powers as an empath allow her to control people. We will see her play an absolutely immense part in Infinity War, only to be thwarted by the idiocy of Peter Quill.
Oh my God. We were right there, Peter.
Like, we were there.
It was a wrap.
We were gonna wrap. No issue,
we were
no blip.
Stop it. No blip, none of it.
No 5 years. This was
and
what all of it was about.
Your head.
Embarrassing.
I'm still
embarrassing.
Mad about it.
It makes me so angry. So the good thing is, because Mantis is such an empath, she connects with Drax, creating one of the best buddy duos in
that.
The MCU. It was delightful to see them in the holiday special together. And she reveals Ego's full plan. This gives the Guardians kind of upper hand. And while Ego is helping Peter harness his celestial powers, which are so immense that they would immediately make Peter the most powerful person in the MCU, they end up battling. He uses the powers to distract Ego. Ego is destroyed. The planet is destroyed. And because Ego is destroyed, Peter's powers are gone. His celestial powers. Because he'd be too overpowered. It would be too powerful. So he's gone.
Let me ask you this. Because clearly the powers are gone, but his celestial hybrid physiology is clearly quite durable.
Yes, and his physiology was noted by the Nova Corps. That's where it kind of first came from. So it is there, and I do think in Guardians, some of the better and best, actually, we kind of talked about this and we'll talk about it more, stuff in Volume 3, we do get to see him kind of have a superhero movements and almost like one of my favorite books and TV series Shadow and Bone, there's a great way that magic works in that, and you will see people who are good at shooting guns, and the gun shooting goodness comes from their skills in magic, kind of like Wanted having, you know, bullet power curving as a superpower. So I kind of think that inherent superheroic nature and celestial physiology, I like that. That's a good catch. It's still there. He's not a celestial fully now, and he can't be like blasting planets, but he's definitely got a little bit more than your average.
I mean, he does
average guy.
He does at the end of Guardians survive. In the middle of Guardians survive the vacuum of space, and
he does survive. Many
spoiler. He continues to be able to be in the vacuum of space without a spacesuit for a extended period of time.
Yes, and sadly, Peter does not only have to say goodbye to his biological father, who was a super dick, so no one misses him, sorry.
Right.
But he has to say goodbye to Yondu, who sacrifices himself to save Peter in an ultimate moment of what the MCU sees as redemption, what we see as good for you, but doesn't mean you didn't traffic thousands of children.
You did traffic. In his final moments, one can only hope that in addition to Peter, the many, many other nameless children... Run through his mind in the final seconds of his life, and we thank him for his sacrifice.
Yeah, and this is really where we get our core Guardians team. Even we have Mantis joins, and we end up, even though Nebula heads off to kill Thanos, which leads us to the kind of events of the big Infinity War and Endgame, she is already now part of the team.
Absolutely.
And you kind of have that core crew going forward into the rest of the MCU and the wider Marvel galaxy.
That takes us to the non-Guardians movie. Now, where have these various characters ended up? The first one where we see some Guardians characters is Infinity War, first non-Guardians movie. We see them in a mission to take down Thanos. They are the away team, basically. They go to Titan with Tony, with Peter Parker, with Doctor Strange. You have Mantis. You have Drax. You have Gamora. You have Peter Quill. And they, again, almost pull it off.
Yes.
They come very, very close.
They come very, very close. But it's Peter Quill. He has a little problem because prior to this, Gamora has gone missing. Viewers know that heartbreakingly, she has been taken by her father Thanos to be thrown off the cliffs of Vormir in a sacrifice for the Soul Stone. As Thanos told us, what did it cost him? It cost me everything. You know, he's feeling sad about it. He wishes he didn't have to kill his daughter, but he does. And in that shocking, one of the most annoying moments in the MCU, I was very happy to hear that James Gunn did not believe that this was the route the character would have taken in the press tour in the lead up to Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3. Peter Quill finds out from a empath-possessed Thanos that Gamora is dead. So he punches him in the head. We are so close. The glove is coming off. The gauntlet is coming off.
Right there.
There will be no click. There Mantis, will be no blip.
I just want to shout out Mantis in this scene. Whew. Because it is her. You really get a feeling for the depths of her power. She's able to keep Thanos, who is he beat up the Hulk. He beat up Thor. He's a match for...
He has many
without
gems.
The stones. Yeah, without the stones, he's a match for almost any of our heroes. And Mantis has him on the ropes for a while.
Her and Drax, ultimate team up. It's working.
It's really, really, really great. So shouts to Mantis. It didn't work because Peter lost his shit. And I get it. It's heartbreaking to find out that the woman you love was thrown off a cliff on Vormir in order to
relatable
acquire an Infinity Stone. But just let us beat him right now.
Be angry afterwards. Take the gauntlet and then do it. But no, he blows up. All goes horribly wrong. The only other member that wasn't on the team at that point, in that very moment, Nebula had been being tortured by Thanos, but she manages to escape. Because he kind of puts the Chitauri in charge. And as we know, the Chitauri can't really get shit done. So she escapes, teams up. And she is one of the few members of the Guardians who does not end up getting dusted. As we head into Endgame.
Let me ask you this. Do androids get dusted? Does synthetic life... I'm not saying it's not life. But I'm saying, would Ultron get dusted? Would Jocasta get dusted?
I don't.
Would Danger, the sentient human formed embodiment of the Danger Room, get dusted?
I don't think so in MCU canon. I cannot really.
Would Cyborg get dusted? Just the human part, leaving just the Cyborg.
Everything. I believe.
Would Deathlok get dusted? Just the human part.
The MCU is too... It adds many more rules. I feel like in the comics, when the blip happens, it's just... You just eradicate life, right?
And it's just biological, like, it's half of life.
He wants to impress Death. He wants to sleep with his girlfriend who's saying no to him, and he does it to impress her. I feel like in the movies, sentient life is a gray area because right. we don't, like, Vision seems to still exist, and that could be that he didn't get dusted.
So Nebula is like a loophole, really.
Nebula is a loophole, I think, because she... Actually, that is such a great point. She is essentially her father's own downfall.
Yeah.
Because he has tortured her so much, replaced her eyes as a form of torture. We see him pulling her apart and kind of going through her memories. Karen Gillan is so brilliant in that role. I really love Nebula. And that is such a great catch because you're absolutely right. She essentially becomes a loophole. And then she goes on to join the Avengers in Endgame and become a primary part of taking down her father.
Yeah, is a huge, and obviously her connection with her alternate self
mm-hmm.
basically sparks the final big fight on
yeah, and
the
her
wreckage
sister,
of the Avengers compound.
Her past sister, Gamora. You know, she is the one who's able to make that connection with her and put her on side.
Next, there's Drax, who we last saw. Of course, he got dusted.
Yes, very sadly.
He came back. He put in a great showing during the big fight at the Avengers compound against Thanos and his forces. And we see him stab one of those big Chitauri beasts in the back, among other
things.
He's
looking tough.
He's a very, very tough guy.
Looking tough.
And later we see him in the Guardians of the Galaxy Christmas special as part of the harebrained scheme to kidnap Kevin Bacon in order to cheer up Peter Quill, who is very, very, very depressed because, one, his girlfriend Gamora died, and two, she came back, but the alternate version they were together and doesn't know him and has no interest in ever getting to know him.
Yeah, which is
and honestly fair
great.
To her because it's such a weird. Imagine coming to an alternate world and being like, "Hey, by the way, we get together later," and you're just like, "I can't see it."
No, and also
thank
like Pia's annoying. Let's be real; like
he's a
he doesn't
bit
have. He's not coming at it with like a romantic or interesting sensibility.
I mean,
but
if
yeah.
you having just watched the Guardians movies back to back, man, Peter makes a lot of his galactic body count in that first
mm-hmm.
movie. He is just talking about the various
constantly.
Scars that he has all over his body
mm-hmm.
as a result of these galactic dalliances with various alien women.
Yeah, we get that really famous scene where he's, you know, he goes up in the ship and kind of flies around crazy, and then the girl comes out of his bedroom and he'd forgotten she was there, you know. So
come on, Pete.
Come on, man. What are you doing? Oh, also, speaking of the holiday special,
yeah.
very important thing to note here. That honestly, I still think is actually my favorite Guardians thing. I loved it. The vibe was just so good. And that was a massive moment for Mantis, who, again, like you said, absolutely smashed it, almost defeated Thanos. Peter fucked it up. Comes back after the blip. And we see her really coming into her own with Drax during the Christmas special, the holiday special. They go on this funny kidnapping adventure, but really the big moment is that she reveals that she's actually Peter's half-sister. She is also the daughter of Ego.
Right.
So that was
she's
a big
celestial hybrid.
Beat for her.
Yeah.
And it explains why her powers are so intense. Makes a lot of sense.
Next up, our good friend Rocket Raccoon played a very, very important role in Infinity War. Goes off with Thor in order to create a new Uru metal weapon, this time an axe.
Oh, yeah.
They go off to Nivodilir and they create this axe. Rocket then plays again a really important role during the final battle. He does not get snapped, notably. And then in the time between Endgame and Love and Thunder, is running around in space with Thor, who is kind of like an adopted member of the team for a period
yeah,
of time.
Yeah, we really thought we were going to get the Asgardians of the Galaxy,
yeah.
and it didn't really happen, but we got to kind of tease it, and then we got to see it a little bit with that one great opening fight scene in Love and Thunder. And obviously, again, going back to Holiday Special, it's Rocket who really befriends Cosmo. Cosmo first appeared in the post-credits scene for Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 1 with Howard the Duck. as part of the collector's collection, but we really get to see Cosmo kind of be brought into the fold in the holiday special, which becomes a major part of volume three.
We should, yeah, so I guess, should we talk about Cosmo briefly then first? Cosmo, of course, the space dog sent up by the Russians during the early days of the space race, just kind of was floating around up there, was picked up by the collector who loves weird, one-off, kitschy things. And here is a dog in a Russian dog in space. Collector loved it, picked him up, picked her up, experimented on her, and basically gave her full human-level intelligence, sentience, and an ability to communicate both with her mind and to use telekinetic powers.
Yeah, and a cool Doug style, you know, speaking collar, which really, really gets used well in volume three. I love to see Cosmo. I think that's one of the coolest.
Cosmo is fantastic.
That's such a cool bit of real history kind of reimagined. Like, what if she wasn't just sacrificed for the space race and instead became this super cool hero? And I guess that's what Guardians does so well, because, I mean, the member that we have yet to talk about what he got up to after, you know, volume two is Groot, who is literally a tree, but has become one of, I mean, sorry, I shouldn't say that. He is an alien species that looks like a tree,
super flora, yeah.
Yeah, super flora. But to fans and people out there, this is a really one of the weirdest, big, strange MCU characters and comic book characters. And the thing I love about it is, like, you see kids now who are going around and they are wearing like a little Groot on their shoulder.
Yeah.
Like, this is a character that speaks so much to who and what the Guardians are and why they've become so popular. It's kind of mind-blowing, especially, like, this is, you know, you're talking about a Stanley's brother, Larry Lieber, and Jack Kirby creation. This is, like, old-school, weird, super iconic creator stuff. And he has become one of the most beloved characters in the whole of the MCU.
And among our core MCU characters is notable for basically being unkillable.
That's what I'm saying. I think it's fair to say he's immortal.
If there is even a splinter of Groot that remains, Groot lives on. Like, you have to chop up his entire body and, like, incinerate it
at the highest possible temperature, because I think a little bit of ash, if there was just a tiny bit of liquid still in there, you could probably plant it and get a new
Group. I think certainly if he creates pollen and the pollen flies off, I think he comes back. Like, just, you know, we've seen him reduced to essentially a twig. We saw him grow up from a baby. In Guardians 3, he is even more able to, like, morph his body than ever before. And essentially unkillable. You can't kill Groot. Groot cannot die.
Yeah, he's a key character, fun character. What's he been up to? He was in Thor Love and Thunder. You got to see him there. We're seeing in the Guardians of the Galaxy holiday special, freaking people out with his buff kind of early 20s body. And obviously as well, he's so popular that he even got his own Baby Groot animated series, which is very delightful. And not necessarily, like, important canon, but just very cute. So that's what they've all been up to. And now they're headed to Old Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3.
Let's get into it. Up next, Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3.
Justin, and so good. Thousands of spring deals at your Nordstrom Rack store. Save big today on new arrivals from Kate Spade New York, Nike, Sam Edelman, Free People, and Madewell. Starting at only $30. Great brands and great prices on dresses, denim, sandals, designer bags, and more. So rack your look and get first dibs on spring styles you want now from just $30 at your Nordstrom Rack store. What will you find?
Whether you're making the same breakfast that you have every day or baking a cake for an extra special day, eggs are a staple in our diets. Eggland's Best eggs are nutritionally superior to ordinary eggs, containing more vitamins and 25% less saturated fat. Not only are they better for you, but Eggland's Best eggs taste better too. There's a reason that they're America's number one eggs. Visit egglandsbest.com for additional information and delicious recipes.
Guardians of the Galaxy, Volume 3. Depending on when you're hearing this, it might come out the very day that you are hearing this. Release date, May 5th. It is the second film in Phase 5 of the MCU after Ant-Man and the Wasp, Quantumania. And we're going to recap it now off the top of our heads.
Wow. Skillful.
Here we go. Because obviously we saw it in a screening. We're not able to take notes, have devices out. And it's been a few days, but here we go as we attempt to do this. So we open on Nowhere, which is now the headquarters of the Guardians of the Galaxy. The Guardians have opened a kind of bar slash headquarter base.
Yeah, like a little PI office. You can come and hire a Guardian.
You can
hire
the Guardians to do stuff, as we saw, you know, just like we saw the opening of Guardians 2, where, you know, they had been hired by the Sovereign to basically kill the battery-eating monsters. I guess you could hire them out, depending on...
Yeah, heroes
for hire. What the rates are. Now, here's the thing. Peter Quill has fallen into substance abuse. He is depressed because... Again, Gamora was killed by her father, Thanos, and then Gamora came back, but it's alternate version Gamora from the past, who never had a relationship with him, doesn't remember him, and is not interested in having a relationship with him. And basically, Peter treats her as if she died, which she did. She did die. So he's basically acting like she's dead, and he's mourning her. But the alternate version, Gamora, remained in this timeline and is now running around with the Ravagers.
Yeah, and Peter's having a rough time of it. He is so wasted in their little bar that we begin the movie with Rocket listening to Creep by Radiohead as all of this is going on. He has taken Peter's beloved Zune. That's how out of it Peter is. He's not even looking after the Zune.
So once again, it's a gig economy in space, and the High Evolutionary, who is the big bad of this movie and is a mad scientist, genius level genetic madman, who also has like various corporations that that are made up of his creations and has even created entire worlds, has tasked the Sovereign and our good friend Aisha, who we learn here are actually a creation of the High Evolutionary. The High Evolutionary created the entire people and world of the Sovereign, has tasked Aisha with getting back his most prized creation. And that is Rocket Raccoon, who we see in flashbacks the things that Rocket endured throughout this movie at the hands of the High Evolutionary. And let's stop here to talk about that, because it is bracing. Folks, we know a lot of parents listen to this podcast. And certainly you're thinking, oh, man, my kid loved Guardians 1 and loved Guardians 2. I would say if you're... kid is like, let's say younger than 13, maybe younger than 11. What would you say?
It all depends on the capacity that your kid has for watching animals in trauma. I feel like it's very specific. I watched a lot of horror films as a kid.
Yeah,
but I was devastated by Watership Down. This is
very much like Watership Down, animals getting put through terrible, terrible things at the hands of one of the most evil characters that we've seen in the MCU.
If you are somebody who uses the website Does a Dog Die, you will likely have issues watching this movie. It has a very vigorous and visceral representation of animals being tested on, of animals being harmed, and some animals... R.I.P. to those animals, sadly
they
being killed.
Animals do die in this movie.
Animals do die. And
fictionally.
Rocket, fictionally. CGI animals made by the hardworking VFX people at the prop store, I believe.
And I will tell you, as a kid, as a as a person who, as a child, rented Watership Down because I saw cute bunnies on the cover of the VHS and thought this will be great, cute bunnies, and was really, really messed up for a little while after watching that film. I could imagine if you're a young kid and you love cute animals that this
would be... Or Rocket Raccoon.
Or Rocket Raccoon. This is going to be a hard watch. Also, I would say, as a person, I had to delay my screening because my dog got spayed on the first night of the screening, so I had to find one the second night. And so going to that movie... Oof. While my dog was recovered for surgery was really rough. It was rough. Yeah,
it's rough.
It was rough.
It's brutal. It can be rough. It's definitely very much in that horror movie vein. And I would also say, you know, far less importantly, but just have to put it out there, if you're a fan of the comic book version of The High Evolutionary, you will likely be shocked because this version is very, very, very evil. The High Evolutionary has a lot of problems, but this is a very... This is a villain who, by the time you inevitably watch him defeated, you are happy. It's extremely cathartic. I love to see it.
We'll get to that. It's a good point, Rosie, because the comics version of The High Evolutionary is a very frosty, remote, emotionally unavailable, cerebral, kind of professorial kind of... semi-villain. I wouldn't call him an out-and-out villain.
Yeah.
But the movie version of The High Evolutionary is
brilliant, evil.
but a raving madman.
Yeah.
Like a stark raving madman who's even his top lieutenants and assistants are like, this
terrified.
Guy is like on the edge of losing it.
Yeah.
Okay, so The High Evolutionary hires the Sovereign... and our good friend Aisha, and her newly hatched Adam Warlock.
Who you may remember from the post-credit scene of Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2.
Who's been hatched. He is fully presenting as an adult, but has the intellectual abilities, of basically like a... Maybe like a 12-year-old.
Yeah, he's a baby. He isn't a baby.
He's really stupid.
Yes. It's a very... He's a himbo, and it's going to be a very controversial read on one of the most powerful characters in Marvel Comics history. Your gig economy question is right. Your point is right. Do not hire the baby alien, even though he's very powerful. He doesn't know what he's doing.
He doesn't know what he's doing, folks. So they hire Aisha, and she sends Adam Warlock to go pick up Rocket in order to return him to the High Evolutionary, who is threatened to wipe out the Sovereign if they are not successful. So Adam Warlock flies to nowhere, is just wrecking shop all in the streets, destroys the Guardians bar/base, is fighting with Nebula, is fighting with Drax, is fighting with everybody. And long story short, they fight him off, but Rocket is very, very seriously injured in the scrap, and unfortunately, they can't fix him. They can't do any medical care on him because there is a kill switch inside of his chest that is copyright registered, copyright protected to OrgCorp, the main corporate entity, the CEO of which is the High Evolutionary. So basically they have to find the unlock key at corporate headquarters of OrgCorp in order to save Rocket's life. Now we are on this mission. The Guardians enlist Gamora, who has been running around with her Ravagers. They actually invade the Guardian ship at one point, and they convince her, hey, let's team up. You want to break into OrgCorp because you and the Ravagers want to steal a bunch of really, really expensive and rare corporate IP that the High Evolutionary has created, and we want to save Rocket. So will you help us? And the answer is yes. So the Guardians, for money. So the Guardians plus Gamora break into OrgCorp, and it is a feast for the eyes.
Yes. This is one of my favorite parts of the movie. We get a classic, powerful James Gunn needle drop. We get space hog, and it's playing. And it's playing as they wear these rainbow-colored space suits and kind of float
into the trailer also,
into
little bits
the
of
ether. And OrgCorp is very fun because it's a organic space, not a sentient being, but an organic space structure.
Right,
so
there's
it's kind
of
gross.
Or very little metal.
It's the space, lots of the skin.
Yeah,
and
it's made
muscle.
Of flesh, essentially.
Pretty gross.
Yeah.
In the best way. And so they get there and they decide that the only thing they can do is cut their way in, seeing as it's skin, which is great. They get in there. They sort of seem like they're going to do a great heist. I have to say, I feel like it's going quite well at the beginning until they come up against Nathan Fillion in a very hilarious role.
Right. He's like head of security.
As the security head, yeah.
Security guy. So a big fight breaks off there in various little groups. You have Mantis and Drax fighting Nathan Fillion. You have Gamora and Peter Quill, kind of Peter trying to rekindle the romance. Actually, just kindle, because again, this is a different person. Just kindle it in the first place. And they're off like trying to steal the flesh ball that
yes.
is the hard drive that contains all the information about the creation of Rocket Raccoon. They managed to get the flesh ball, but it doesn't contain the key. The key they discover has been downloaded into the neural implant of one of the two top assistants to the High Evolutionary, who they learn is not in OrgCorp headquarters. He is on Counter-Earth in his pyramid, other is pyramid shaped corporate building there. And Counter-Earth is a kind of continuation of the experiments that created Rocket Raccoon. The all of this time, the High Evolutionary has been trying to create very, very smart animal hybrids that are peaceful.
Yes, he wants to create a utopian world. And for some reason for him, that includes making animal-human hybrids. And this is very interesting because it's a Counter-Earth is a big comic book thing from High Evolutionary's past, created by Roy Thomas and Gil Kane. And it's this idea of a purer Earth.
Yes.
It's a better version of Earth. And that is what he is going for here. But as we see, there are many problems on Counter-Earth that are just the same as real Earth. Even if you do fill it with very, very, very brilliantly brought to life animal-human hybrids.
And now it seems like, you know, they land in a suburb, and for the most part, everybody seems very generous and very nice. There is an animal-human hybrid family that takes – they look like they are
bat
hybrid. They take Peter and the team in and give him delicious drinks and point him in the right direction where to find the High Evolutionary. But also on the outskirts of the suburbs and kind of like closer into the city of Counter-Earth, there's like, you know, there's drugs, there is crime,
there's homelessness,
violence, there's homelessness. And this is a sticking point for the High Evolutionary, who is views Counter-Earth essentially as a failure and is currently onto another experiment in this line of experiments to create a utopia. He's created these other creatures who are very smart. They can solve all these kind of mathematical problems. They can repair starships. But he's still tinkering with it. He's not quite happy with it, but they all exist as children.
Yeah. And he believes that the key to fixing his problem and creating a true animal-human hybrid super being is Rocket Raccoon, because Rocket is the only one of his creations that's ever been able to innovate. Every other one of his creations, he feels like can just repeat things that he's taught them. But Rocket was incredibly smart. Rocket was actually, as we learn in a flashback, it was Rocket who worked out how to make the animal-human hybrids peaceful. It was to do with a filtration system. The reason Rocket is still alive is due to his own innovation and creation with building things and inventing things. In fact, Nebula has a very cool new arm in this movie, and we learn that it's Rocket who created it. So we're really getting to see how his horrific past encouraged his intelligence and inventiveness, as well as this kind of trauma and anger that it obviously gave
him. During these flashbacks, we meet Rocket's friends who are part of the same batch of this animal experimentation that the high evolutionary was doing. Now, these are evolved up animals that have been given various kinds of cybernetic implants, very rough and very hard to look at ones. But so these friends of Rocket's are Lila, who is a sea otter with metal arms. Teefs, who is a walrus with big wheels for hind legs. And Floor, who's just like a very delightful, very sunny, very, very optimistic little bunny rabbit with kind of metal arachnid legs.
And a scary mouth.
And they all create these names for each other, and they all bond over the idea that one day Master, the high evolutionary, is going to create this utopia, which ends up being Counter-Earth. And they are going to get to live there in freedom and stare at the sky. And it is fucking heartbreaking shit.
Yeah.
Real talk. Like, it is really, it is hard. And again, this is where if you want to take a young kid to this, it's going to be rough. Because like me and his adult, I was like, this is rough.
It's really rough.
And it makes you hate, you fucking hate the high evolutionary. Mm-hmm. You hate him. Will hate the high evolutionary.
And if you have read the Grant Morrison, Frank Quitely comic from Vertigo, We Three,
we suggested it on one of our comics.
Yeah, we've suggested it in the past. It's such a brilliant comic. It's heartbreaking, but it's hopeful. And it essentially works as a story about three animals who are created as prototype weapons and their kind of journey to freedom. And it is very, I think, fair and likely to say that was a huge influence on Floor Teeth.
Oh, for sure.
And Rocket's journey. And James Gunn is a huge fan of Grant Morrison. We know Grant's work will be a large part of their next steps at DC. So it's kind of wild to see a little version of We Three come to life, especially in Floor, who I feel like is very similar to the rabbit in that pirate, who is just heartbreakingly sweet and optimistic in the way they talk. It's really brutal stuff. I'm very
It's very brutal. X-ray Vision will be back.
Price drop? Time to shop. Get to a Nordstrom Rack store today for first dibs on new markdowns. Now score even more, up to 70% off brands everyone loves at Nordstrom Rack. Denim, dresses, sneakers, tops, and more. Plus, get genius deals on jackets, sweaters, and boots for the whole family. Shop your Nordstrom Rack store today and save up to 70% with new markdowns. But hurry, deals this great won't last.
Whether you're making the same breakfast that you have every day or baking a cake for an extra special day, eggs are a staple in our diets. Eggland's Best eggs are nutritionally superior to ordinary eggs, containing more vitamins and 25% less saturated fat. Not only are they better for you, but Eggland's Best eggs taste better too. There's a reason that they're America's number one eggs. Visit egglandsbest.com for additional information and delicious recipes.
Fashion's Biggest Night was Monday, and just like every other year, Anna Wintour made sure to make this year's Met Gala red carpet mandatory watching. But did you know that before she was the editor of Vogue, Anna Wintour ran the fashion section for a little-known porno mag called Viva in the 1970s? Check out Crooked's latest limited series podcast called Stiffed to learn about the rise, wink, 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 and fall of Viva, the erotic magazine for women that rocked the publishing world in 1973 New York City. With a team of feminist writers and editors behind it and Porn King publisher at the helm, were they always destined for failure? Find out now by listening to Stiffed, available for free on your favorite podcast platform. And we're back. back. So the High Evolutionary is in his pyramid-shaped corporate headquarters on Counter-Earth. And the Guardians figure out that he's there, and the High Evolutionary knows that they know he's there, and in fact, he has set this trap because he wants Rocket Raccoon. The Guardians have Rocket Raccoon, and he knows that they need the key in order to unlock the corporate trademark lock on time lock on Rocket's heart in order to save his life. And this will allow the High Evolutionary to have Rocket basically delivered right into his clutches. And it kind of works. So the Guardians go to the corporate headquarters, and there is a big fight there. And
one of many shootouts in the movie.
The High Evolutionary we should add that Adam Warlock, who is saddened at the death of Aisha in one of the previous scenes, goes to Counter-Earth, basically gets his clock cleaned, and then kind of soft joins the Guardians of the Galaxy, or at least adds him. It goes
unwilling
on their side.
Because what we learn about the High Evolutionary, and we can assume that the Sovereign is one of the lucky communities this didn't happen to, he has gone through history creating these new worlds and then destroying them if they don't live up to his.
Right.
You know, so when they got to Counter-Earth and Counter-Earth's going to be destroyed because there's these drug problems, there's homelessness, he wants to do it again. I thought the Guardians might try and save Counter-Earth, but it's too late.
Too big a lift.
Destroying it. It's happening.
So Peter and Groot get the code, get the passcode from the head of the assistant to the High Evolutionary.
And not just like his memory, his literal head. They kill him and they take it out of his head.
And take the head and take the piece out of the head. And while this is going on, the High Evolutionary has triggered the destruct of Counter-Earth. All of Counter-Earth and the untold millions, if maybe not billions, of animal hybrids that live there are all in the process of being destroyed. Peter gets the code back. They save Rocket's life. And as they're saving his life in the present, we get the flashback of basically how Rocket escaped from the clutches of the High Evolutionary. He discovers that the High Evolutionary plans to kill all of them, kill his friends, kill them all. So he puts into motion an escape plan, which he had apparently been working on all of this time. He had hidden little pieces of machinery all around his cage, and he puts them together, and it's a key in order to escape. He escapes from the crate, opens the other cage to get the other animals out, but the High Evolutionary shows up with his guards. They open fire, and very, very, very sadly, Rocket's friends are killed. Rocket flies into a rage. He jumps onto the High Evolutionary and literally tears his face off.
Literally.
And then jumps in a spaceship and escapes. And then, we don't know what happens until we catch up with him at the beginning of Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 1. Now, we learn about that, and then as they're working on Rocket, it seems like it's not going to work. They've unlocked his heart, but the heart isn't beating. And Rocket is near death in some kind of limbo state. His consciousness is walking into a light. He sees his friends. He sees Lila comes to him. And this is, again, I'm like actually getting choked up talking about it. Lila comes to him.
They know everyone's going to be crying at this point.
Lila comes to him. Tiefs and Floor are there in the background. And he's so happy to see her. And he's like, oh, finally, I can just be with my friends. And like, yeah, we can be together. We're going to do that, Lila tells him. We're going to be together one day and just stare at the sky, all of us together, and be friends. He's like, this is so great. Finally, I can rest. And then she puts her metal hand on his chest, and she says, but not now, because you still have something to do. He needs to go back, and he needs to fight with the Guardians and free all the children that are the current experiment of the High Evolutionary. So he comes back to life. They go to the High Evolutionary's now spaceborne pyramid. They invade it. They free all the kids. There is a wonderful – so the High Evolutionary has put out the alert, like, okay, all forces, be on alert for the Guardians. Get me Rocket Raccoon by any means necessary. Kill the rest and do what you have to do to get them. That sets up, and this is a wonderful subversion. We've talked a lot on this podcast and elsewhere about the third act big fight problems that Marvel often encounters, right? I think this is one of the smartest, if not the smartest, subversion of that trope that Marvel has done yet. So rather than have this big showdown with the High Evolutionary, right, the big boss, the big fight is with his henchies, including mm-hmm. these half-animal, half-android cyborg creatures and a bunch of human guardsmen. And it is awesome.
Like, they do such a good job. It has this great, these large one-shots, this really interesting use of slow motion. It really speaks. I think it's a great callback to some of the earlier fights that really made Guardians stand out, but it's been streamlined to the point where when you see it on that big screen, it's incredibly impressive.
It recalls the fight on Ronan the Accuser's ship from the mm-hmm. first one, but with the kind of scope and ambition and general coolness of the big Infinity War portals fight. Like, it's okay. That kind of thing.
But moral question here.
Oh, yeah, let's talk about this.
You mentioned the cyborg animal hybrid kind of characters who are used as part of the body count for the High Evolutionary. What are the morals here? Like, we're saving the ones who look like humans. Rocket was one of the ones who was unfinished and was kind of androidy. I feel like that's one of the things for me where I was left thinking about it afterwards, where I was like, who gets saved and how do we try and save them? And I understand they didn't have a lot of time to answer those questions.
This was a moment where I did find myself wishing for some kind of, just even a line about how sad they were.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like something in The Matrix. I remember that moment in The Matrix where Neo is having explained to him that everybody they see in The Matrix is a person, mm-hmm. and that occasionally that means they're going to have to kill people who are plugged into The Matrix. But that's just the way it is because they're trying to free everyone. In order to free everyone, they're going to have to fight these pieces of the system that are trying to imprison them. I found myself wishing that there's mm-hmm. something, some kind of justification like that, where it's like, listen, we wish we could free these very, very aggressive and hyper-violent and hyper-loyal creations of the High Evolutionary, but we can't because they're trying to kill us. I did find myself wishing that had happened, but that does not happen. Kill them all.
Lots of killing.
There's a lot of killing. And the fight scene is freaking incredible. And then the final showdown with the High Evolutionary is a really cathartic, like, 1 minute fucking beatdown. The High Evolutionary, with his gravity powers that he upgraded his suit ever since Rocket tore his face off. He's like, never again. And gave himself gravity powers. Well, Rocket had created a kind of like anti-gravity power device that he then triggers after a little while of getting thrown around by the High Evolutionary. And he just proceeds, along with the rest of the Guardians, to beat the living tar out of the High Evolutionary, who then lies, you know, before them. And everybody's like, okay, well, Rocket, if you want to finish him off, you go ahead and do it. And then Rocket says, no, I won't, because I'm a Guardian of the Galaxy. I won't. And which is, again, a very, very noble statement, which comes after they kill
so
a lot
many
of
people.
Other creatures.
I mean, there's literally a moment where we get, within an hour, Star-Lord is saying to Drax, we can't kill anyone, we're Guardians, that's what we do. And then Star-Lord and Groot go into a room where Groot pulls out many guns, which I will say, I do not believe he needs to kill people. But, and then Chris Pratt, Star-Lord says, kill them all. But now you don't kill if you're a Guardian. I feel like there is a morally complex conversation to be had there. But I understood where Groot was. I understood where Rocket was coming from because he has been tortured. And he doesn't want to enact that violence on the man who did it to him.
I'll say this. When Peter Quill says kill them all, at that point I was absolutely on side. Because all of the people in that room were human
enablers.
Top C-suite followers of the High Evolutionary, not the hybrid animal guards.
Yeah.
It was just like the most evil top-level cadre of the High Evolutionary. And I was absolutely like, yeah, get rid of
them. You were like, I don't want to see any of them anymore. I don't want to deal with it.
So they take down the High Evolutionary, and as the High Evolutionary's ship is crashing, they then go on a mission, much like Noah's Ark, to save as many of the creatures that are on this crashing corporate headquarters as they can. They start with the sentient creatures. So it's like the very, very smart animal hybrids who aren't still trying to kill them, and this race of white-haired children who was, again, the latest experiment that the High Evolutionary is working on. They get all the kids off the ship, but then Rocket, you know, visits the area where he was kept in the cages and decides, no, we're saving all the animals too.
And the monsters.
And the battery-eating monsters, three of them from the beginning of Guardians of the Galaxy 2. There's three of them kept on this corporate headquarters, and they Mantis basically turns them into friends, which then made me retroactively sad that they sliced that one open.
Yeah, because she realizes, she actually realizes that they are not inherently aggressive creatures. They're just defending themselves. Yeah, they just want to eat a battery.
That's all they want.
I love to see Mantis and her new monster buddies. So yeah, they save everyone and everyone ends up on nowhere, which I'm very glad that Celestial's head was so big, because you're talking about a population bump of like at least 5,000.
So there's all these are Terran animals now on nowhere. And one would imagine all these children creations of the High Evolutionary and some hybrid creations. And they join a ragtag cast that was already living on nowhere, including Kraglin, who helps out in the big fight and successfully learns to use Yondu's whistle needle. In a wonderful moment where he kind of sees the visage, like a vision of Yondu, like basically urging him on, saying like, you could do it, you can use this weapon, as they're defending nowhere from the creations of the High Evolutionary. It's a nice moment, from a now deceased child, multiple time child trafficker. The Broker is hanging out with them on nowhere.
Yeah. Cosmo, she's doing some cool telekinesis. She's a good dog.
She's very, very powerful now, we see. Mm-hmm. She's able to keep Nowhere and the corporate headquarters, the High Evolutionary corporate headquarters, like in parallel orbit for a period of time just using her telekinetic powers, which is
wow,
like Jean Grey
MVP, Cosmo MVP.
Jean Grey level stuff. There's a wonderful subplot with Kraglin and Cosmo where he calls her a bad dog, and it really just bothers her for basically the entire movie.
Yeah, it's really great. And then she gets her good dog moment when she smashes some people with some giant rocks. So all good stuff. Love Cosmo.
And Peter once again survives the vacuum of space.
I thought he was going to die.
I thought he was done. No guardian perishes.
Shocking twist.
But the original team does break up. Peter decides, you know what? I've got some unfinished business on Earth. My grandfather's still alive. I'd like to go visit him. Drax says, I don't even know who I am. I've been fighting all this time. I've now met. He really had an immediate connection and affinity with these children created by the High Evolutionary. And it makes him think of what he missed with his daughter, who was killed by Thanos, and now he's basically gone off to raise these kids. Mantis also leaves because, honestly, being an empath is wearying, and she's just been carrying the emotional baggage of all of this team for all of this time. She's just fucking burnt out.
And she needs to know who she is, so she takes her battery-eating monsters and off they go.
Beautiful. You love it. You love,
I love
to see
it.
And the new team, who we see at the first stinger, is Rocket Raccoon, leader, now retconned as basically a super genius.
Yes. Who has accepted that he is a raccoon.
He's accepted.
Because he would always say he was
said
never.
It said
it on his cage. So he finally, he says,
he's
I'm
like,
Rocket Raccoon.
I guess I am. So leader, Rocket Raccoon, Cosmo.
Yes, love to see it.
Which I think, wonderful addition.
Perfect.
One of the children rescued from the High Evolutionary, who we discover is Phi Lavelle.
I would say almost certainly with the purple flaming hands that seem to be able to create weapons. Very cool deep cut addition there.
Adam Warlock, the baby.
The baby Warlock. The baby. He's there. He's being charming. He's being bumbling. He's bringing a Hugh Grant energy to the entire thing.
And Swole Groot.
Swole Groot.
And it's a wonderful team. They're out in the galaxy, just basically still for hire. And then where do we leave Peter? We leave Peter on Earth. He goes back. He visits his grandfather, who recognizes him instantly, despite the fact that he's now an adult. And last time I saw him was like 11. Something in the eyes, I would imagine. We leave them around the breakfast table just talking about mowing lawns.
Mm-hmm.
And the words that come across the screen as the movie ends are...
The legendary Star-Lord will return.
In what, you might be asking, no one knows.
No one knows.
All in all, an emotionally powerful MCU film.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it depends. Your mileage may vary depending on how big a Guardians fan you are. I like the Guardians. I love Rocket Raccoon. I love Groot. I love Gamora.
The Gamora ending is actually my favorite part of the one of my favorite
really
parts of the movie.
Yeah.
We end up in a situation where so Nebula and Drax stay on Nowhere. They're going to raise these kids. They're going to run Nowhere as like a safe space for people, a safe home. And rather than make Gamora and Peter fall back in love, which didn't seem at all natural to the character,
agreed.
We get to see Gamora return to the Ravagers as a hero. And there's this great kind of, there's this really wonderful 5-minute montage at the end that kind of shows where everyone is set to the Florence and the Machine song, Dog Days Are Over, which was definitely emotionally manipulating me in a positive way. And we see Gamora, and when she returns to the Ravagers, we get this great like 30-second thing of this is her found family. In this version of
That's
the world,
right.
She fits in here. It's not the Guardians. It's with the
That's
Ravagers,
right.
And they're hugging her, and they're like giving her, you know, they're rubbing their fists on their head. And it's just, it feels really great. And I love to not see them try and pull some kind of fate romance kind of thing.
It would have felt weird.
It would have felt really weird.
And it was nice to have to your point, this kind of parting where it's like Peter really wants it to happen, but it doesn't. And he makes his peace with it.
Mm-hmm.
And it just feels very earned and natural. And honestly, with Gamora returning to the Ravagers, I feel like she will hear the horns of freedom when she dies. The colors of a gourd absolutely will flash over her grave. Shouts to Gamora. I thought visually it looks great for any of the people who were disappointed by the kind of CGI tone palette and aesthetic texture of Ant-Man and the Wasp: Quantumania. This is much cleaner. And
it has a very clear vision, and it's a very colorful, pulpy, engaging, immersive vision. It fits very well into that world of Guardians of the Galaxy. It's a Guardians movie.
The creature work is unbelievable.
Yes, the creature work's unparalleled in the MCU.
The High Evolutionary is certainly one of the most evil characters and the most effective villains that we've seen. I'll say this about the animal experimentation stuff, which again, it's going to be hard for some people to palate. I think one of the things that Marvel has struggled with in the post-Endgame phases is stakes.
Mm.
And they've kind of fallen back on stuff like, oh, my daughter, oh, my family, this flashback of this thing that happened. This, Doctor Strange the Multiverse of Madness was like this romance that like with Christine that like never really got off the ground anyway when they were together. And so I do respect that they went to a place that we hadn't seen before to create the stakes to make you hate the villain. But
yeah.
It is something that will be, I think, hard for people who love animals and kids to watch.
Yeah, I have very complex feelings about the whole movie, but my biggest kind of takeaway is that I love that we live in a world where a movie this weird can be seen as a commercial movie. It is extremely weird. It swings for the fences. For me, some of that stuff lands. For me, some of it doesn't. But this is a movie about a talking tree, a talking raccoon, aliens, and they're fighting their way through organic space stations to save human-animal hybrids. And it's probably going to be one of the biggest movies of the year. And that is the power of comic books to me and comic book storytelling. And that's the thing that still makes me excited about these movies and the potential that they have.
I mean, you mentioned the space hog drop where they're kind of floating towards OrgCorp. There are lots of moments like this where, for no reason at all other than James Gunn is in his bag tying up a movie, he'll give you a slow-mo shot or a 360 camera angle or this shot that like lingers on the characters' faces or the weird way they float through space. And there are many of these that don't necessarily need to be there. And if they do kind of need to be there, they certainly don't need to be that long.
Mm-hmm.
But the weight of all those things makes it such a unique visual experience.
And those were some of my favorite things.
Absolutely.
Those were some of my favorite things. Those moments where you linger, where you give the time to the atmosphere, to the vibe, to the character, to the story. That's the stuff that makes this really hit.
So what do you think? Star-Lord TV show? Is that what they're going to do?
It feels to me. Legendary Star-Lord.
You know what they're
going to
do? Is he going to be Captain America? Is he not Captain America? No, but I'm dead serious. Is he leader of the Avengers team?
You know what? They're going to need a Cosmic Avengers.
I will say he will be on the Avengers team. He will be on the next Avengers.
I think you can take that. Look, the truth is, we're going to need a Cosmic Avengers because
he knows about Celestials. He lived in a Celestial head.
Whatever happens next, there's going to be a lot of cosmic multiversal shenanigans. So having somebody who has connections to the Celestials, the Eternals know that stuff in a creepily oversight type fashion. So I'm sure that they were probably aware that somebody on Earth is part Celestial, you know? So I think you're right. I think a legendary Star-Lord type appearance in the Avengers team as a leader or co-leader of, I think there will be many Avengers teams as we lead into this next phase.
Right, space team, Earth team.
I think that's very likely. I also do think the legendary Star-Lord, I think that sounds like a Disney Plus show, and you do it where he's going around the galaxy kind of having very Guardians-esque fun. But we'll have to wait and see because I don't know. I think that people who really love these movies, they love James Gunn's Guardians of the Galaxy. So what does that look like without him?
Well, I can't wait to see. That has been our coverage of Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3, the end of this iteration of the team, and certainly the end of James Gunn's relationship with the MCU, although it certainly seems like James Gunn's brother will continue for a while, seeing as how Kraglin is on the team.
Yeah.
Right?
I think so.
That's fine, right?
Yeah, like the truth is that actors exist in both these worlds, Marvel, DC, otherwise as well. And I think that will continue. And with James at DC and James having such a deep history at Marvel and these movies in general not necessarily becoming the $1 billion blockbusters that the corporations want them to be, we're not far away from a Marvel DC crossover.
Agreed.
And James is somebody who I think would be very interested in that.
Up next, Nerd Out.
In today's Nerd Out, where you tell us what you love and why, or a theory that you're excited to share, Tony shares a Star Wars theory.
Tony writes us, I could nerd out about a great many things, but Star Wars and the Marvel Universe, comics and movies, are near the top of my list. Long story short, my Star Wars fan theory is that the downed Star Destroyer we see at the beginning of The Force Awakens is Thrawn's Chimera, or Chimera 2, if the Purge will completely destroy the ship. I think that the climax of Dave Filoni's movie, this is good, that is itself the culmination of the Star Wars streaming shows to this point, will be the Battle of Jakku.
I would love to see it!
Which we don't see, but happens, you know, before we catch up with the events of The Force Awakens. Dave Filoni's saga has run in parallel with the cinematic saga to this point, telling its own story but referring at strategic times to the larger rebellion, and this event offers a great opportunity to do both. We will see all of our streaming heroes come together, including a full-on live-action Rebels reunion, complete with Freddie Prinze Jr. as Kanan's Force Ghost. Oh my God.
People really want to see it. They really want to see it.
Yeah, and you know what? He looks good. Like, I think
he's looking good.
Freddie can do it. I theorize that we will also see other members of the Dameron family, more CGI Luke, Kelleron Beck, and Lizzo with a blaster.
I would love to see it.
Yes. I hope that there's an appearance by the young Vice Admiral Holdo. They will all come together in an Avengers Endgame-style galactic extravaganza. Thanks for an extremely entertaining podcast, and may the Force be with you. Thank you. May the Force be with you.
May the Force be with you.
It's May 3rd today, but, you know, one day early, may the Force be with you. I'll say this. We understand, certainly there have been rumblings that Star Wars, you know, the Star Wars IP world and Kathleen Kennedy want to do some kind of team up. They've been hunting for a team up thing. And I love this.
I think this would be such a cool way to do it. And I mean, it's kind of hard to imagine because we live in a post MCU world, a world where the MCU exists and kind of changed Hollywood. But I mean, a Star Wars event movie. Star Wars movies used to be the event movie. So doing a Star Wars event movie, you could be making the biggest movie on Earth, especially with how much people love the TV shows and the movies, and to bring all of that together. I think this idea sounds really cool. Tony, keep this one in your pocket. Pitch it. Pitch it to Lucasfilm. Thank you so much, Tony. If you have theories or passions you want to share, hit us up. xray@crooked.com. Instructions in the show notes.
That's it for us. Rosie, any plugs?
I will be at Jeffrey's Comics in the LA area, specifically Torrance, one of my favorite places in the whole of America. I will be there with so many other cool artists on Free Comic Book Day. You can come and get free comics. And if you are not in our area, your comic book shop will have free comics. It is the rule of Free Comic Book Day, May 6th. You can go there, you can grab comics. Maybe you could give some donations of some food. Lots of different shops do it different ways, but you'll be able to get free comics. And if you come to Jeffrey's, I will be there signing things. I'll have some new zines that I'm making to prep you actually for Guardians of the Galaxy. I'll have some fun new zines about some of the characters and their comic book history that will be free. I will also have Godzilla stuff that you can buy. It will be rad. And I will again say, check out the Hero Initiative because they do a lot of amazing stuff for the creators who made these characters possible and made this whole world possible and made the state of Hollywood today possible. So check out the Hero Initiative and support it where you can.
I will plug the WGA, the Writers Guild of America. We're currently on strike against the Alliance of Television and Motion Picture Producers. Here's the thing. These corporations are enormously profitable, enormous profits. The CEOs, the eight CEOs of these corporations altogether made like more than $750 million, $800 million range, which if you're scoring at home is more than the 2% raise that writers are asking for. And there are various other problems. I won't bore with you with them. All of which is to say, these studios sell one thing, and that is the stories that writers write. And we're at a stage now where writers, if my only job was writing for TV, I would not be able to be living. It would be very, very tough. Because listen, you might make a good rate on a weekly basis, but you might only do 8 or 10 weeks of a mini room and then not be able to find anything for 3 months, 4 months, 6 months, 8 months, a year, because it's getting harder and harder. And we talked a lot and joked a lot about the gig economy on this podcast, but the studios basically want to create a world in which writing for TV is a gig economy. They'll pay you by the day. They'll have AI kind of create the outline, and then maybe they'll like hire a couple of kids like on a day rate to punch it up, whatever the computer created. And then they'll put that out as cheaply as possible so that the CEOs can continue to garner their enormous, enormous, enormous paychecks. And so that they can serve not the interests of the people who consume stories or the people who create the stories, but the shareholders. Again, these corporations are seeing enormous profits.
So
but
much money.
But because the profits aren't the kind of profits that scale at the level that Wall Street likes, all of this is seen as a failure. David Zaslav pulled in some $300 million last year, and this is for basically shepherding Discovery into buying a thing that it can't afford, which resulted in numerous layoffs, and we're seeing layoffs all around the space.
Billions of dollars of debt.
So support your WGA writers, support writers, post about them. If you see posts from writers on any of your social media platforms, give them your support. They would appreciate that.
If you do want to be bored, my stories on my Instagram are a source of constant WGA information. I have many links to many stories, many different posts, places where you can go and pick it with our friends in the WGA. So if you want to be bored by it, Rosie Marks, my stories, that's what I'm using them for at the moment, is just to share the stories of writers, the realities of what this is like, because even this job wouldn't exist for us if people didn't write these stories.
That's right. That's very correct. Catch the next episode on Wednesday, May 10th for more market moves and a return to the wilderness with Yellow Jackets on the Beleaguered Showtime Network.
You are not ready for that one. And you can also subscribe on YouTube, where you can now watch full episodes of the show. Sometimes we are here on Zoom. Sometimes we are in the fancy studio. You can follow us at XRVPod on Twitter, where we share all kinds of cool things, and you'll get to keep up with the podcast. And check out our Discord. You can join by going to the show notes, hang out with a ton of amazing fans and listeners who talk about all kinds of cool stuff in very in-depth ways. And me and Jason show up there sometimes.
Five-star ratings, five-star reviews. We need them. We got to have them. You got to give them to us. Here's one from Allison Gower. Absolutely awesome. It's so fun to listen to. It's a great way to bond with my teen son, who, like me, is a huge comic Marvel DC fan. We listen together, and he often stops you to explain more to me. No notes. Love you. Thank you so much, Allison.
Thank you, Allison.
And shouts to your wonderful son. X-Ray Vision is a Crooked Media production. The show is produced by Chris Lord and Saul Rubin. The show is executive produced by myself and Sandy Gerard. Our editing and sound design is by Vasilis Fotopoulos. Dylan Villanueva and Matt DeGroot provide video production support. Alex Relaford handles social media. Thank you, Brian Vasquez, for our theme music. See you next time, folks.
Bye.
Rack your look for spring at Nordstrom Rack. And save up to 60% on brands you love. Rag & Bone, Vince, Marc Jacobs, Adidas, Joe's, and more. Great brands, great prices every day at Nordstrom Rack. Score new dresses, denim, sandals, designer bags, and sunglasses. Plus, updates for the family and home. Get your spring on for less, up to 60% less, today at your Nordstrom Rack store. What will you find?
Whether you're making the same breakfast that you have every day or baking a cake for an extra special day, eggs are a staple in our diets. Eggland's Best eggs are nutritionally superior to ordinary eggs, containing more vitamins and 25% less saturated fat. Not only are they better for you, but Eggland's Best eggs taste better too. There's a reason that they're America's number one eggs. Visit egglandsbest.com for additional information and delicious recipes.